Good evening and welcome to Chain Reaction. My guest today started off on Reeves and Mortimer, then went on to don a romper suit as a giant baby on Shooting Stars. He found success on Radio 4, which doesn't really count for much, let's be honest, with Little Britain, but then it moved to telly, where it became hugely successful. There are three things you need to be a success in comedy. Timing, wigs, and a giant blue romper suit. My guest today has all three in spades. I wanted to interview him because, quite simply, he's very, very funny. Please welcome Matt Lucas. Well, I thought you were funny for years. I saw you as a stand-up. It must be 10 years ago now.
Yeah, could be.
I think it up the creek or somewhere.
Oh, God. Did I get booed off?
No. It went extremely well.
Oh.
And now the first thing for me... I mean, Little Britain, I think, is probably what you'll be, you know, best known for.
Yeah.
And it's quite a peculiar thing. It's been incredibly popular, and it's very easy after something's been that popular just to go, well, of course, because it's very funny. But it's quite... It's a very odd comedy.
I think it's quite traditional. I mean, people are... I think it's the most mainstream thing we've written, and it's playing on BBC One now. So I can't think of it as odd, but people do tell me it is odd. How is it odd?
Well, I think it's strange in that it largely involves dressing up as ladies and being gay.
Yeah. David Baddiel said it should be called Goodness Gayness Me.
It's not a bad idea. So, how do you write?
Well, there's a shop called The Comedy Shop, where we go and buy ideas.
Well, I just mean in terms of the voices more than anything else. I presume that's where it comes from initially.
Actually, it doesn't really start with a voice usually. David in particular is very keen that's almost the last part of the process, that we write from inside rather than from the outside, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you don't start necessarily with the way a character looks or speaks, but you come up with a concept, like David brought to the table the idea of the teenage boy who's got a crush on his friend's grandmother. We don't know what those characters are called yet or how they speak. It just starts off with that idea.
Mainstream comedy ideas, like a boy fancying his mate's grandmother.
Yeah, or, you know...
Mainstream, very much like Barrymore or...
You know. Yeah, or a 40-stone woman in a health farm who still hasn't paid a bill or...
You are an incredible sort of mimic. It says that the voices you can do.
Right.
Were you not tempted to just kind of... I mean, it would have been a very...
I mean, who am I? I don't even know who I am. I mean, you know, who is the real me? I don't know.
It must...
That's what this whole enterprise is trying to discover.
It must have been a...
Even the episodes in this series that I'm not in, because of the chain, come back to me to try and find out just who I is. Well, what were you going to say? Stop me before I make a bigger fool of myself.
I was going to say, because, I mean, you can do very good impressions of people. Did you never think, well, I'll just do that, it'll be easy?
Well, I don't think our impressions are that great, and we did a show called Rock Profile, where we did our sort of
very accurate.
Do you think so?
Very accurate.
Barry Gibb as a lion is one of David's.
And didn't lots of things sort of come out of that, though? The Rock Profiles, I mean, I was sort of surprised when I first saw Little Britain that you hadn't put a little bit of Rock Profiles in it.
I tell you what, there is one thing in Little Britain, which is the Dennis Waterman, which is a sort of unimpression of Dennis Waterman, which is sort of in the Rock Profile tradition. But what you thought, we'd do more sketches with people like Elton John and things like that.
I thought so. I mean, I know that some of the sketches came out of... David was telling me you did something with Lou Reed.
And Andy Warhol, and that's where Lou and Andy came from. And
yeah.
Why they called that, yeah. That's true. So we used it as a few...
So Lou and Andy are Lou Reed and Andy Warhol.
Well...
Because I don't know if you'd get that immediately. I mean, now you say it, it's obvious.
Yeah. We did some sketches for a show called The Ralph Little Show, and David did Lou Reed. And there is one bit in the sketch where Lou says to Andy, "So, what do you want for your lunch?" And Andy goes, "Chippy." "Well, fine, but you know, if you go to Chippy for your lunch, you can't go to Chippy for your tea. So, where would you want for your lunch?"
"Chippy."
"Right, so what are you having for your tea?"
"Chippy."
"No, I don't know what it says." And Andy, "Yeah, I know." So it's just that, right? And just that little bit, you know. But then there was no wheelchair then, and there was no sense of someone in a wheelchair who could actually walk, and that all came later, really, the idea of... But that beginning of that relationship of David's character having a kind of, you know, looking after my character, started there.
I think that the strangeness that I'd refer to in Little Britain is the fact that it's sort of based in a reality, in observations of people that we recognise. And then it's got that just sort of very, very strange, surreal touches. It's the never explained that I love.
Some are and some aren't. I mean, we try and do lots of different types of humour. So, you know, particularly in the second TV series, there is some gross out stuff. And then there is some just very odd stuff, like Mr. Man, we call him, who always goes into a shop, and it's the same guy working in the shop every week, but selling different things. the one about Margaret. And David's character always asks for very specific things. I don't think that there's much observed in that. But there are characters. I mean, one of the popular characters in the show is Vicky Pollard. Mm-hmm. And there is a satirical sense. I mean, it's just, that's just quite fortuitous in a way, because it's just a time when suddenly everybody's noticing what they call chavs. Really. And it's just something in the air. It's a bit like... And
when I first read that, I thought it was Charve.
Charve.
That's how posh I am. I see there's Charves in the paper. They're everywhere.
There was a moment, and I'm not claiming success on this level at all, either creatively or commercially, so I make that clear, but there was a moment when, like, Harry Enfield had loads of money, and it was just right for the time. People just went, oh, my God, yeah, there really is someone like that in the late 80s, and Sasha had it with Ali G, where everybody suddenly knew someone who was talking like that and kind of wanted to be black in that way. And people do seem to come up to us and go, I know a Vicky Pollard, my daughter's a Vicky Pollard, or...
My daughter's a Vicky Pollard.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like a Trisha title.
Yeah.
Well, we've just done a sketch of Comic Relief where Vicky goes onto the Trisha show, and I was sitting in that seat thinking, I knew I'd be here one day. I knew with the dysfunction of my life I'd be here one day.
That's great. No, I do think it's kind of captured a bit of a zeitgeist, that.
Yeah, there's just a slight sense of that, yeah.
Does it ever annoy you that some characters, you know, are really popular and some aren't? Because I imagine your favourites aren't necessarily the public.
Well, actually, the thing about Little Britain is people have different favourites anyway, they seem to have. But, no, I'm not annoyed. I'm just grateful that anyone likes any of it, really. I think it would be churlish to react against people enjoying a part of your show. I enjoy doing Severna Chumley very much. So there's a few characters that are slightly lower key, but it's great that we've done something that people seem to enjoy. It's great for us.
Yeah.
It's nice for my mum. She likes to talk about it.
The other thing that I wanted to mention was it's got quite a lot of sort of stuff about being gay.
It's a very puffy show, yeah.
Yeah. Couldn't be more puffy. Now, you're one of them puffs, aren't you?
Yeah.
That I've been hearing so much about.
Yeah. That's the medical term for it, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, did that kind of inform it at all, or do you just...
Well, I think you write about what you know, and...
You know a lot about latex.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually, you know, quite a conservative dresser, but the great thing about having a camera on you is it legitimises any strange behaviour. So, in this current series of Little Britain, as Andy, I run naked into the sea, which is something I would never do, but... Because there's a camera on me, I can sort of justify doing it.
Yeah, as long as millions are going to see it, it's fine.
Yeah, it's sort of worth it. But yes, it's a very gay show.
Do you like that? I mean, is there...
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I think what's nice is that, a bit like Goodness Gracious Me, where, you know, the show does have an identity, and that is part of its identity, because we write from what we know, but at the same time, I don't think it excludes people. The main aim for Little Britain is to make something that A, makes us laugh, and B, entertains as many people as possible.
I mean, I really like the fact you took it up a gear in the second series, and that it changed a bit, and it was a bit more, you know, there was the gross out stuff, and there was the stuff that was shocking, because it almost like tuning in for the first time. I remember I went to the screening of the first one, and felt like it was a comfortable old pair of shoes. Thought, oh, Little Britain, oh, lovely, some new skin, oh, brilliant. And then it was actually quite surprising, because it sort of had ramped up.
Well, it was filth.
Yeah, when it was dirty, dirty, horrible filth.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I'm partial to.
Well, you know, it's a weird thing because a lot of people, sometimes we get asked by journalists about, you know, being offensive, but I think people often get offended on other people's behalf.
And I think more often than not, yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the things people talk about is, like, for instance, the vomiting women. And for me, the more offensive thing in that sketch is the political views of those women, not the vomiting. But when the vomiting is done, it's done in a very cartoony way. It's done in a very ridiculous, heightened way.
Let's start at the beginning,
okay?
Shall we?
Yeah.
Looking at you, as you're quite a striking-looking fellow.
Gorgeous, people say.
People do say gorgeous, yes. Yeah. A modern-day Yul Brynner.
Thank you. Yeah, well, this is when I was 6 years old, all my hair fell off. Out. So, yeah, so that sort of forces you to sink or swim. And I sort of didn't want to get known as the boy with no hair. You know, I wanted to kind of achieve something else.
So you've had a massive hit comedy on the BBC. That's gone very well.
Yeah, that's cool.
It all fell out.
Yeah, basically.
It all fell out, so yeah, I don't think tells the whole story.
No. Okay, what happened was, when I was 6 years old, my hair started to fall out. And I think it was over the course of about maybe 2 or 3 weeks, maybe 6 weeks. not that much longer than that. And I would wake up in the morning and find loads of hair on my pillow. And it didn't fall out in a nice aesthetic way. It didn't sort of recede, it just sort of clumps.
Although if you had been receding when you were six, that would have been really quite disturbing.
That would have been strange also. Yeah.
And you started to smoke a pipe.
Yeah. but grew a beard, even though my hair was falling out. So that was kind of weird. And quite cruelly, my hair then started to grow back about a year later, but then fell out again. So thanks for laughing at my trauma. So don't patronise me either. And so...
They can do nothing right.
Nothing right. There's no way you can fix this. So that was kind of hard, because I think it was quite hard during adolescence, because you want to fit in. You don't want to stand out for any reason.
So, yeah, and you do, I mean, you do stand out. You're a very striking-looking guy.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it has been a massive advantage, because the characters you play in Little Britain, you're a blank canvas for sort of wigs and weird things that you do, and you look entirely different in every different sketch. But
yeah, makeup artists really like me, and yeah, for a fat bloke, I do sort of look different, don't I, each time, so that's great, yeah. And the first wig I wore was when I was at school, when I was in my last year of primary school, and we got a wig on the National Health. There was no system then for wigs for kids. Wigs for Kids, that would be a good name for a shop. So
that's quite specialist.
What happened was, I got a woman's wig, a lady's wig. That's all there was. And I went to the shop and the wig was cut to fit my head, as it were. But so I had quite big hair, sort of almost a bouffant. And I wore this wig to primary school for a few weeks, but I used to do a mow molum and sort of take it off when I got hot. And of course, some sort of common rough kids in the year above me would run past me and pull it off and do the Benny Hill thing on my head. So I had to make a decision when I was off to secondary school whether I'd wear this wig or not. And in retrospect, I'm really glad that I didn't, because what had happened if, like, one day in the fourth year it had suddenly come off, it would have been too weird. And also, I didn't have eyebrows, so I think it probably looked quite weird. But I still have the wig at home, and it was the first wig I wore as Sir Bernard Chumley. When I was doing stand-up, that was
really
the wig, yeah. And I still wear it sometimes when I do the act.
I mean, you seem incredibly kind of cool about it, but it's quite a thing.
Yeah, I think in the grand scheme of... Well, there's two things, right? In the grand scheme of things, it is the sort of thing that you could let screw up your childhood if you wanted to. But, you know, ultimately there are people who've had a much, much tougher time for other reasons, so you've got to put it into perspective. Also, you know, it hasn't really done any harm in adult life, and it probably has been a contributory factor to some of the success I've had, even if it just gets people to recognise you and remember you. So, you know, I don't like to think of it as a horrible disadvantage.
Now, you mentioned wearing the wig the first time you performed Sir Bernard Chumley.
Yeah.
Now, you did that as stand-up. That was your sort of stand-up character.
Yeah, what happened was when I was about 16 years old, I started auditioning for things like the National Youth Theatre. Stuff like that, which you just do in the summer holidays. And I wrote an audition piece, which is a monologue of an old, ageing actor. That's all you know, like this sort of thing. And it went quite well, and I got into the youth theatre. And so when I was 18, I started doing this stand-up routine in pubs and clubs on the alternative circuit. This is the end of 1992. And I was just really, really, really lucky, because after 5 weeks of doing this, I'd probably only done 3 or 4 gigs, Bob Mortimer was in the audience at this club I was playing for new acts, and I did the routine, and I noticed that during the set, Bob came from the back of the audience and came and sat in the front row and was really laughing. And I really idolised Vic and Bob, so I just couldn't even believe I was in the same room as him. And then after the gig, he came up to me and introduced himself as Robert Mortimer and said he worked for a company called Channel X. I just thought, why are you introducing yourself? You're Bob. You're so weird. I stayed in touch with Bob, and I met Vic through him, obviously. And within a couple of years, I was working for them on The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, and then Shooting Stars.
And then did that, because you stopped doing stand-up in the clubs.
I stopped doing stand-up in the clubs around about 1996, 1997. Mainly, well, two reasons. Firstly, I didn't do George Dawes live, and I enjoyed doing Sir Bernard Chumley, and that character was really being developed. And it just felt more natural for me to perform as Sir Bernard. But audiences would get quite frustrated with me because I'd walk on stage and they would want me to be wearing a big pink romper suit. And so...
I often get that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel it's there, tacitly underneath.
Yeah. So there was a slight sense of disappointment, I think, from audiences. They sort of sort of wanted to see me but didn't because I wasn't doing what they wanted me to do. And also, I just... It was shortly after my dad had died, and I was in a hotel in Manchester, and I played a gig supporting Frank Sidebottom. Do you remember him with a big paper mache head?
Yeah.
And I remember the only room left in the hotel that I could get was one of these rooms in the roof. So the only window was it was in the roof. And I was just lying back on my bed, and I was just I had done a good gig, but I was just lying there, and it was about 3 a.m, and I just thought, this is really lonely. This is I don't want to do this anymore. So I just pretty much stopped overnight.
Was it the death of your father that made you sort of think...
No, not really. I just thought, this is just lonely and this isn't that much fun. I just stopped enjoying it. I'd had a gig where I'd got booed off a couple of years earlier. I used to get booed off a lot, and the sort of act that I had would either go one way or the other, so it would either bring the house down, or I'd have to leave by the tradesman's exit. So I did this gig, and it was a horrendous gig because it was an Edinburgh festival. Vic and Bob were doing a gig at the Edinburgh Playhouse, which is 3,500 people. And the gig was supposed to start at 11 o'clock, but there were some technical problems at the venue, so the audience were waiting outside. And at 1:45 in the morning, I got on stage at the Edinburgh Playhouse, playing to a very drunken audience. And they were quite dissatisfied because they'd been waiting a long time for the show to start. And I got on stage, and I was actually doing really well, and then something happened. I just kind of lost them. And I got booed off in front of 3,500 people. Not by 3,500 people, by about 100 guys, but I just got booed off. And something went from me that day. And I carried on doing stand-up, and I carried on doing gigs that went down really well. But I got fear after that. And straight after that Edinburgh season in 1995, I went on to support Blur.
Are you making a proportion of this up or all?
No. No. All of it. No. I went on to... I did, just really, really bizarrely, Damien Hirst had been engaged to direct the Blur video for Country House, and he remembered meeting me, and he wanted a bald guy to run around in the pop video and be chased by girls as a kind of nod to Benny Hill. So
I can't argue with that.
And I got on really well with them. And basically, after I did Edinburgh in 1995, Blur asked me to go and support them on tour. And some of those gigs, I lasted 90 seconds on stage.
90 seconds?
90 seconds, yeah.
So walked on, didn't go great? Or was it a brilliant 90 seconds?
No.
You should have written more stuff.
I should have had more material.
That seems an extraordinary thing then. So, I mean, I think being booed off in front of 3,500 people must just be an incredibly soul-destroying thing.
Yeah, that coupled with the difficult experiences on the Blur tour, even though I wasn't playing to a comedy audience.
It's much more of an American thing, actually, the opening up for rock act.
Yeah.
I know a lot of American comics that do it, but it never really took off over here.
No.
It's a very bad idea.
It's a bad idea. The famous story is Tommy Cooper opening at Wembley Stadium for Sting, and Tommy Cooper getting booed off and having bottles thrown at him and walking off and passing Sting in the wings and saying, "Follow that." But, no, it doesn't really work. It doesn't really work. And, so that gig and the gig at the Edinburgh Playhouse just imbued me with a little bit of fear.
And you're back doing live stuff. I mean, I saw you, I was lucky enough to be at the Albert Hall last year doing, you performed some Little Britain things at
that was the first time we'd done that. Yeah,
they were phenomenal live.
Thank you. We're back doing stand-up, and actually, I've been doing some gigs as Marjorie Dawes hosting award ceremonies, and I absolutely love it. Marjorie can say things that other people can't say, so people come on. Somebody came on the other day to collect an award, some girl, and I said, it wasn't very nice what she was wearing, and I said, oh, I thought CNA had gone bust, but you've obviously got contact. You know, and I just found I had a kind of voice as... in this character, you know, and I should make it clear that me and Dave write the character together. So, and a lot of comedians do these gigs. The really cool ones, in fact, even do them and don't want you to know about it.
Oh, no, we all like a corporate.
We all like a corporate gig.
About 2 a week, me.
Right. Yeah. I really, really enjoy them.
They're great fun, yeah.
Because it's
someone's Christmas party, more often than not.
Yeah.
It's the National Insurance Awards. And you go, right, I imagine that'll be dull. And, of course, it isn't because they're all ripped.
Yeah.
And trying to sleep with their secretaries is hilarious.
It's great. And also, you can say you find out who the boss's name is, and then you say something outrageous about them, and so they're great fun. So, yeah, we're starting to do some live work, but in a year's time, at the end of 2005, we're going to do a national stage tour, and it'll be our first stage tour since 1997. And we're really looking forward to it, because we started out doing live work, me and Dave, and we used to get up to quite a lot of, I don't know if you saw our early shows together, but we were quite naughty and we'd sort of chuck people out like Barrymore and we'd confiscate their shoes and stuff like that, and kind of cause a bit of a riot.
Now, I suppose we've sort of talked about you sort of getting into comedy and becoming a performer, but your relationship with David strikes me as a very, very sort of important thing. And I think probably most people won't be aware it's been 10 years.
Yeah,
you've been an incredible overnight success with Little Britain.
Yeah, David said we've been 10 years together and the first 9 years, you know, 9 years of crap and 1 year of success, you know. Which is quite a pessimistic way of looking at it, really. We've really enjoyed it. We met in 1990 in the National Youth Theatre.
And did you immediately like each other, or...?
Well, David always says that he didn't want to meet someone else who was funny. And we were in the halls of residence in Tufnell Park, and we've told this story quite a lot, but I did a Jimmy Savile impression, and David did a Frankie Howard impression, and so we were introduced to each other to sort of swap impressions. And we did. And then the next year, there was a production of The Tempest.
Has that got Frankie Howard and Jimmy Savile in it?
No.
I'm not familiar with Shakespeare's work, but...
No.
Were you cast opposite each other?
No, David was Trinculo, and I was... This is so embarrassing. I was... I would bring scenery on and off, and I would watch him from the side of the stage every night and just think, this guy is hilarious. When I was 17 in 1991, I had two ambitions. One was to one day meet Vic and Bob, and the other was to one day perform with David Williams. And
it's gone very well.
It's gone all right, hasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's almost perfect.
Yeah.
The Vic and Bob thing we haven't talked about much. That's where you first got public attention.
Yeah. All I can say is, like, they were my idols, and they still are, and they were the reason me and David became comedians, because we saw their work and were so enamoured of it. And watching Vic Reeves' Big Night Out was like being part of a club. And I remember watching it the first week and thinking, And then the second week going, all right. And then by the third week just being in hysterics.
Yeah, and it was like a gang.
Yeah, it was like a gang, and it was this kind of sleeper hit as well, and it was great to feel, yeah, I got it a week before you did.
Yeah.
You know, and it was something that I would come home every day from college and watch, and it wasn't like anything else that was on TV, and I just adored it. And so, you know, to work with Vic and Bob is something I still get really, really excited about, and last year I had a part in their series Catterick, and, you know, we still speak to each other, and I remain, as much as I'm a friend of theirs and a colleague of theirs, I just remain a huge fan of what they do. And I think kind of all roads begin and end with Vic and Bob, as far as I'm concerned.
It's interesting, because Vic and Bob, sort of their career, they've done a lot of different things. I'm sure I'm not the only one. I wish they'd done Big Night Out for a lot longer.
Well,
I wish
think...
they'd done The Smell of Reeves and Mortar for a lot longer. You said, you know, we all have kind of favourite things that they did.
Yeah.
Do you think the same thing's going to happen with Little Britain? Are you going to be tempted to go and do something else?
I think the secret to the sort of partnership that me and Dave have is that we do also do other things as well as working together. And I did, like, just things. I did a musical in the West End, and I did a Shakespeare play at the Old Vic, and I tried to do other things. And David is also building up quite a reputation as a kind of serious actor.
Oh, yeah, he's been in EastEnders.
He's been in EastEnders. he's worked with Richie and Wallace. That's something he's very good at, doing proper acting, as my grandma would have called it. So I think we can keep it fresh by going and doing those things and then coming back and having something to talk about, in a way. We're going to do a third series of Little Britain. And then...
Good news.
We're going to do a live tour. And then after that, who knows, maybe I'll just stay at home and eat crisps.
What sort of flavour?
Just plain.
So the live tour, how are you getting? I mean, the logistics of that must be. Have you given that any thought?
Cause yeah, we're just going to have some. What we're going to do is we're going to get like Elton John and Robbie Williams and Rod Stewart and George Michael to just kind of do bits while we're off stage. And, I don't know. I'm really excited about it, and so is David. And it's something we sort of talk about every day, and we're asked about a lot. We're really, really excited about doing it. We don't yet quite know how much how we're going to do it. But I do know that it's important that we spend time on stage together, that it doesn't just become one is on while the other is getting changed.
Yeah.
I think it's really important that we spend time on stage together. Otherwise, we'll never get to see each other.
No, it was extraordinary at the Royal Albert Hall, the reaction that it got, because you did some sketches that had been on the TV and people clearly knew.
No, they were all new sketches.
Were they new sketches?
You lie, you'll bring me here and lie to me. They were all new sketches, yeah.
They were samey, though.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that. They were pretty much the same. No, they were. We did write some new sketches, but it was the same sort of thing.
And is that
only gay in village, etc.
And is that the,
yeah, I know, etc.
Is that the is there kind of a sing along element to it in terms of going to see it? And
yeah, I think when you go and see a live comedy show and it's with a smaller audience in a more intimate venue, then you can do a different show to when there's maybe a few thousand people there, and that becomes almost a celebration of the TV show. So yeah, maybe we'll have pass out sheets with all the catchphrases on. People can join in.
Sing along.
Yeah.
You have a little karaoke ball in the back.
Yeah.
But what else have you got coming up other than Little Britain then? I mean, it sounds tremendously busy if you've got another series and a tour.
It's to be busy. I mean, it's non-stop. I am doing a small part in the new Russell T Davies adaptation of Casanova that Peter O'Toole is in.
Casanova?
Strangely not. Amazing, not. That.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it's just a few scenes, but it was really good fun to do. I'm a big, big fan of Russell T Davies' writing. And I'm doing currently, really been enjoying doing the voices for a new cartoon series with Rick Mayall and Moana Banks and Phil Cornwell. And I must say, Rick Mayall is just an inspiration. And it's just so entertaining to
what's
be
that
in
called?
That company. It's called King Arthur's Disasters. And the other thing is, I haven't done it yet, but I want to open up a really big chocolate shop.
A really big chocolate
yeah.
shop?
Yeah. I'd like to open up a really big chocolate shop where you can go in and it's like a destination. It's not like something you just pass. You actually make a point of going there for the day. And there's loads of floors, whole floors dedicated to white chocolate, different type of
Toffee crisp floor.
Wing. And then I would like a little train that you can ride in that goes around. And what I want is you to be able to go in there and design your own chocolate bar when you arrive, and by the time you come out, to be given your own chocolate bar that you made.
Wow.
Yeah, don't know how I'm going to do it, so don't be that amazed by it.
So do buy the Little Britain DVD.
Yeah, please do.
All funds are going towards this largely charitable endeavour.
In fact, if there was Jim or Fix It still going, I would write in and ask.
What? My name's Jim. I've got some connections in the confectionery business.
Yeah, would you mind?
We'll make it happen. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Lucas.
Thank you. There we go.